L'Officine Universelle Bouli presents Ancient Beauty Rituals, Episode 8. The Queen Who Inherited Genghis Khan's Wars. How the fiery and wise Alakai Beki, the daughter of Genghis Khan, runs the state and builds her legacy, early 13th century Mongolia. There is a Khan's daughter who steps on in a swinging manner and has the marks of 20 tigers, who steps on in a graceful manner and has the marks of 30 tigers, who steps on in an elegant manner and has the marks of 40 tigers, who steps on in a delicate manner and has the marks of 50 tigers. An epic Mongol poem. A rider on horseback, galloping across the stark flatland of the Gobi desertscape and towards the imperial yurt, came into sight. "It's the Beki," announced the guard outside the yurt's entryway, recognizing the queen's towering hat of felt and feathers. A flock of white cranes flew high above her, like a queen's entourage. "Praise the eternal blue sky and the earth mother who watch over us. She's just in time. I foresee that the prince consort will depart for the other world soon," spoke the shaman somberly, the beads of his robe rustling as he sent his prayers to the skies. Two other women tending to the gravely injured Genghe, the prince consort, looked on, fearing the worst. He had been on another dangerous military mission for his father-in-law, the great Genghis Khan. "Being the great Khan's son-in-law is almost a death sentence," lamented one of the women. "Yes, one can hardly envy their prestige," replied the other. Outside, Alakai Beki, the daughter of the Khan of Khans, Genghis Khan, and ruler of the Ongud tribe, quickly dismounted from her steed and rushed to her husband's bedside. "Genghe, my love, do not worry, for I am here," she whispered tenderly, half believing her own lies, knowing he was slowly slipping away. As a young woman, she had learned to read and write and had a deep knowledge of medicine. She had saved Genghe once, years ago, helping both of them escape to her father's camp during the Ongud rebellion against her. She was barely 20 at the time. Her then-husband, Alakush, had been killed, and as per custom, she later married her elder stepson, Genghe. After her father's army had quashed the rebellion, she went on to resume her rule. But Alakai knew she could not save Genghe this time. The injuries were too grave. She kept the poultices down, the burnet roots to suppress bleeding, and the globe flower for chest pains. Tears stained her cheeks. The traditions of 13th century Mongol medicine systems were rooted in both nomadism and shamanism, with practices such as the Kumis treatment, immersion therapy, herbal medicine, and shamanic healing rituals like bone setting. Shamans were considered to have supernatural powers of healing bestowed by the spirits, and they could be either men or women. Robes worn by shamans often carried symbols such as a drum and a hobby horse, representing the guardian and protector spirit of the Mongol people. Kumis was a kind of fermented liquor prepared from mare's milk and was used both as a popular beverage and medicine by Mongols in the 13th century. It helped to recover from wounds and to strengthen their bodies. Scientists have found kumis to contain protein, fat, lactose, amino acids, vitamins, and trace elements of minerals. In immersion therapy, the affected body parts were bathed or immersed in warm oxen or horse blood. It was also used to cure fevers and other afflictions. The practice of bone setting can be traced back to before the 13th century, to the periods of Inner Asian nomadism. Bone setting skills were either handed down in family lineages, or in some cases were believed to be imparted by ancestral spirits through dreams. Ancient Mongols were also well aware of the importance of dietary medicine and various foods. As per historical records, the mother of the future Genghis Khan, in order to take care of her small sons, foraged for wild plants such as crab or wild apples, bird cherries, the roots of the great burnet and silverweed, wild garlic and onions, the bulbs of the wild lily and wild leek. This points to the fact that early Mongols had the necessary knowledge about plant nourishment for specific conditions. Leaving Genge under the supervision of the shaman, who was administering various balms to his wounds while muttering sacred words of healing, Alakai stepped out and looked over the expanse of the great land that lay in front of her. The howling of the cold wind filled her with a sense of foreboding. Her thoughts went back to the first Kurultai, held in 1206 by her father. The Kurultai was a large political meeting that aimed to bring the various feuding tribes and allies under the Mongol banner. It was when the great tribes acknowledged Genghis Khan as the Great Khan, ruler of all. Amongst the many tribes that came were the Ongud, her father's trusted allies from beyond the Gobi. They came mounted on camels and bearing gifts of silk, wine, and soft camel wool. The Ongud were semi-nomads and also lived in walled cities. As she curiously watched the Ongud men with their carts full of fine gifts, Tolui, her know-it-all brother, whispered in her ear, "You know, Alakai, their women are fed perfumes since infancy, so the bees and butterflies follow them. Also, their noble women paint their faces with yellow lead and lips with the ashes of fragrant flowers. They're skilled at poetry, dance, song, and play many musical instruments." Alakai remembered feeling greatly inadequate, for her main interests lay in sword fighting, archery, and horse riding. Nonetheless, after the Kurultai, the chief of the Ongud, Alakush, sent her father a proposal, seeking Alakai's hand in marriage, seeing an opportunity to strengthen his presence beyond the steppe. The great Khan gladly accepted his offer. "My dear girl, I have found you a suitable husband in Alakush. You will go there as their Beki, representing our tribe and me. With power, strength, beauty, and grace, you will make them your people and rule over their hearts and territory." He spoke with tender fatherly affection, tinged with authority. 16-year-old Alakai felt a new world of responsibility settle on her delicate shoulders. She knew this was not just a marriage, but also a Mongol expansion plan. She had always been her father's favorite child, cast in his shadow. As a child, she loved to sleep with her weapons, her bow and arrows, just like him. He had even gifted her a sword decorated with tigers, its hilt inlaid with jade. "I am ready, father. I have raced horses and aced the bow and arrow. I have watched you rule with courage, justice, and resolve. My mother, Borta, has instilled in me the duty to serve the nation. I will be my parents' true daughter and make you proud." Her eyes shone with ambition, as if lit by a fire within. She had been bred to rule. Yet, with nervous anticipation, she also looked forward to meeting her future husband. Underneath her warrior queen spirit beat a young bride's heart. The daughters of Genghis Khan held the title of Beki, and their marriages were fixed for political advantage. As the Khan's daughters, they became the de facto ruling queens of the territories they were married into. If the husband had any previous wives, he had to divorce them to become the Khan's son-in-law. The future bride typically brought with her a dowry consisting of such valuables as livestock, jewelry, cloth, servants, and possibly slaves. During the wedding ceremony, the bride stood in front of her new yurt and put on her bokta, the tall headgear of a queen. It imparted a statuesque height and regality to her person. The frame was made of willow branches and covered with green felt or red silk. It rose in a narrow column 3 to 4 feet high, gradually changing from a round base to a square top. A variety of decorative items such as peacock or mallard feathers adorned the top. Mongolian women's bokta also had a special role. As men and women's clothing were nearly the same in design, appearance, and function, reflecting thousands of years of more or less equal gender rights, the women's tall headdresses served to differentiate men and women from a distance. The higher a woman's position, the taller, richer, and more elaborately decorated the headdress. Before entering her new yurt, she would walk between two large fires that sanctified her so that she might enter her marriage in the purest state. Despite the harshness of the land, Mongol women had naturally clear skin and cheeks flushed a rosy pink. This has been attributed to living off the land, having simple foods, nutrient-rich yak milk and meat, the minimally processed healthy fats added to giving the skin a youthful texture. Yogurt made from milk of animals that graze on open land, made for excellent treatment for acne and brightening the skin. The nutrient-rich sheep tail fat helped keep the skin well moisturized and protected it from the natural elements of sun, wind, and cold. The nomadic way of living also meant that people got a lot of exercise, moving camps, riding horses across the steppes, setting up and dismantling yurts, looking after the livestock, etc. The sharp cry of women from inside the yurt broke Alakai's reverie, and tears streamed down her cheeks once again. She knew that Cenge had crossed to the other side, just as her first husband, Alakush, had. She silently called upon the spirit of the sacred mountain, Burkan Khaldun, also her father's refuge in times of crisis, to bestow upon her the strength and wisdom to continue protecting her people during this time of grief. Memories of her first wedding to Alakush came back to haunt her yet again. She recalled her father's instructions at her marriage. "You should be determined to become one of my feet. When I am going on an expedition, you should be my helper. When I am galloping, you should be my steed." He left no doubt that she was on an assignment of not merely administering over the Ongut, but ruling, expanding the Mongols from a tribal nation into a global empire. When her mother, Borta, placed on her head the Beki's headdress, two curving horns of black leather on a cap of crimson felt, twisted with gold and dangling waterfalls of white and red beads, Alakai's eyes welled up. "You will bring greatness to the Mongol nation, Alakai," her mother sought to give her courage while hiding her own grieving heart. She mounted her horse, wearing her mother's gift of new tunic and trousers, dyed with the juice of red goji berries. A caravan full of weapons and provisions, silk and silver, taken from vanquished enemies, along with the Khan's soldiers, accompanied her to Alakush and her new people. As she left, her mother performed an ancient ritual of the steppe, throwing milk in the air with a wooden instrument resembling a large perforated spoon. The milk held a special prayer that the road ahead of her be smooth and well lit, literally and metaphorically. "We need to prepare, Beki," her principal advisor's voice brought her back to the present, "for sending the prince consort on his journey onwards, and for your future. Prepare my husband's cart and place his belongings in it. Also prepare his mare and horse. He must not lack anything in the other world. He will be buried by dawn. Run the horses across his burial site so none can know where he lies," spoke Alakai stoically. 13th century Mongols buried their nobles like the Egyptians, with belongings and artifacts that they felt would be useful to the dead in the afterlife. The Mongols even went to the extent of sacrificing and burying a beloved person of the deceased, and animals like a horse and a mare, so that the dead person did not lack anything in his new life. The rituals differed depending on the status of the one who had died. The Khans and noblemen were wrapped in felt packed with sandalwood for its fragrance and also to repel insects, in room-like burial chambers dug into the ground. The body was then placed in the chamber with the dead person's belongings. After filling up the chamber with earth, horses were run across to remove any sign of a burial place. This was to protect the graves from being vandalized and any desecration. Another possible reason was the Mongol belief in assimilation through annihilation, meaning the deceased becomes one with the great entity and no distinction remains after the union. Burial customs for common people involved placing horse skins and at times impaled horses over the burial sites, possibly to please the sky god Tengris. Cups of fresh camel milk and leather sacks of dried horse meat were left as offerings to spirits. With the burial over and passing of the mourning period, Alakai returned from Genge's camp to her palace in the walled city. After she wed Alakush and came to this city, she had preferred to stay in her own yurt close to her husband's palace. It would be some time before she got used to walls and buildings that seemed to imprison her free nomadic spirit. Now, Alakai faced some immediate decisions. Your younger stepson, Boyoho, will return from your father's military campaign soon. He is 17 and suitable to be the next prince consort, spoke her principal advisor, as Alakai sat in her official chamber, contemplating the future. Sunlight streaming through the window reflected off the gold thread embroidery of her yellow silk robe, seeming to cast a halo of brilliance around her. Her eyes traced the patterns of clouds woven on the borders of the fine woolen carpet under her feet. Motifs of birds in flight and flowers reminded her of freedom and open skies. But with power came responsibility and sacrifice. She was a queen, and no longer free to give in to her whims and girlhood dreams. With Genge gone, as per custom, her younger stepson was in line to be her next husband. She was already in her mid-30s, but she knew that marriage would be a political move to strengthen the Mongol-Ongud alliance. Pouring herself some kumis in an ivory bowl engraved with depictions of the five snouts, horse, sheep, goat, cattle, and camel, she looked at her reflection in the liquid. She could still pass off as a 20-year-old. Then there is the matter of the Tangut, who are again causing trouble on our trade routes, the advisor continued. Alakai stood up. Her demeanor transformed from that of a grieving wife to queen of the people. When she spoke, her tone had a steely resolve. The Tangut tribe have long interfered in our control over the Silk Route. My father, the great Genghis Khan, has trusted my sisters and me with keeping the trade route secure. I cannot fail him now. Prepare 10,000 men and horses to go with my father's army, so that the Tangut learn never to meddle with our lands again. She was not known as the princess who runs the state for nothing. After her father, Alakai was the highest-ranking Mongol south of the Gobi Desert. Once Genghis Khan consolidated his Mongol kingdom, he sought the luxuries of the modern lands for his people. They had heard of merchants a few thousand kilometers away who sold silks that glided over the body, iridescent pearls and glittering emeralds, delicately carved combs for fixing the hair, and magical cosmetics and potions that claimed to reverse aging and infuse virility. The Mongols also wanted decorative baubles for their tents, horses, and for themselves. They were mesmerized by stories of bamboo wood that was light enough to float on water, yet strong as metal. Compared to the wealth of other nations, their own nomadic lifestyle seemed drab. Controlling the Silk Route, the famed network of trade roads between China, India, and the Mediterranean, became the next goal for the expansion of the Mongol Empire. Now the Mongols could fill their carts with silken threads, porcelain bowls, brass pots, and more. They carried jugs of perfume and makeup made from ochre, yellow lead, indigo, flower extracts, fragrant waxes, balsam, and musk. An important passage therein was the Gansu Corridor, a lowland between the Tibetan and Mongol plateau that acted like a funnel for the trade, and which had long been dominated by a Tibetan tribe called the Tangut, which later formed an uneasy alliance with Genghis Khan. Genghis strategically married three of his daughters, including Alakai, into kingdoms that later controlled the Silk Route. But he had to continually keep the Tanguts in check, who rebelled every now and then. Alakai supported her father's campaigns with men and ammunition from her army. Boyaho arrived to pay his respects to his departed brother and meet Alakai. He knew that his future would now be enmeshed with his brother's widow, and it would be his duty to be the next prince consort. "I am glad to see you, Boyaho." Alakai addressed him with quiet formality. "We have to prepare our men to subdue the Tanguts, and we do not have much time. I have sent word to my father. Tomorrow morning, before sunrise, we will head to his camp and present him with our plans for preparation." Boyaho couldn't help but admire the woman's fierce spirit. "Yes, my Beki. I will prepare my men and myself to join our great Khan's army in his conquest of the Tangut rogues." He respectfully bowed his head, stealing a glance at his future wife's beautiful face. Destiny had made him the consort, custodian, and protector of Alakai Beki, a legendary woman who would continue to fire up the imagination of men and women for centuries to come. Sensing a long night of planning ahead, Alakai called for some refreshing and detoxifying dried orange peel puree. The citrusy beverage would keep them alert and awake tonight. Made of equal parts fragrant orange peel and prepared mandarin orange peel with a mix of sandalwood, kudzu flowers, mung bean flowers, ginseng, cardamom, and roasted salt, all ground to a powder, it was taken after mixing with hot water. Alakai and Boyaho sipped the drink in porcelain bowls, silent and deep in thought over their next moves. As the first rays of the rising sun fell upon the palace, the breeze carried the royal shaman's incantations, praising the elements of water, earth, and skies, seeking protection and success for the Beki's important journey ahead. At the palace gates, Alakai and Boyaho briefly removed their hats and belts, paying their respect to the elements, bowed to the sun, and mounted their horses, speeding towards the Khan's camp, a day's ride away. With the wind stinging her eyes, Alakai felt love rising up in her. Not for a man, but for the Mongol nation.
This was an episode of Beauty Rituals Through the Centuries from Officine Universelle Bully. You will soon find a new story that will take you on a journey through time. Our podcasts are available on all listening platforms.